Well, hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGBM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgbm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. I am sitting here at sunset on our deck, and there's a, I think it's a mule deer up in the backyard, browsing. It's really calming to just watch him. Some of my neighbors are driving home. You might hear them on the gravel road. But anyway, I just thought I would share this evening with you. How have you been this week? Did you get to the Sweet Pea Parade, or did you get over to the KGVM booth at SLAM? Well, early Wednesday morning, I got up between 3 or 4. Sometimes I wake up in the wee hours. Do you? Well, anyway, I walked over to our north windows and saw something I haven't seen in weeks. Stars! Even with the crescent moon rising over the hills in the east, the sky was smokeless and strewn with bright stars. I saw the Pleiades and that constellation that looks like a big W doing a handstand. And I bet the Big and Little Dippers were up there too, maybe hanging out behind a little stray cloud. I just stood there, taking it in for a few minutes. So this week, our Desert Oracle Radio episode is titled Mountain of the Stars, created by Ken Lane on August 14th, 2020. He talks about the Yuma and Mojave tribes, as well as the Spanish history in the desert, and how those cultures live on in names of places there, among other things. And of course, as the name of the episode implies, stars and mountains come up into the story too, and much more. This episode is one of my favorites and might have you rethinking some place names here in Montana. After the break, we'll hear about tribal people in Glacier and in Yellowstone National Parks, but for now, here we go.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. The desert I'm in tonight is the Mojave High Desert, south of Barstow, north of the Salton Sea. The Spanish pronunciation Mojave, in its various spellings, means beside the water. Somewhere along the way, it came to mean the desert west of the Colorado River on either side of the mostly underground Mojave River, which begins in the snowmelt of the San Bernardino Mountains. Mojave is from the Yuman words, Ahamakav, which is where the Yuma people have lived for almost 1,000 years on the Colorado River, roughly between today's Fort Mojave and Yuma, and throughout the Colorado Delta and today's Mexico, atop the Gulf of California, the Sea of Cortez. Both Fort Mojave and Fort Yuma were built by the U.S. Army to stop raids against white travelers by the Mojave tribes, which rightly saw the incursion as an invasion. The Mojave sued for peace after losing a decades-long advantage, and today many thousands of Mojave and other human peoples live throughout the California and Arizona deserts. The names of places are rich with meaning. Even when a town or a county is just named after the real estate developer or some state legislator, over time the name becomes a crucial clue to the history of a place, the scandals, the disasters, the rise and the fall. Now, many places in the Southwest retain their old names, or at least are named after a tribe. Mojave and Yuma are examples. Washoe, Tahoe, Taos, Apache Junction, Navajo County, Winnemucca, Tucson to Tucumcari, Tehachapi to Tonopah. Many place names in the Southwest retain their Spanish names, the rivers and the mountains especially, Sierra Nevada, San Bernardino, Santa Fe. The dominant pronunciations have adapted to a long occupation by English speakers and slow reconquista by Spanish speakers, because all things are in motion. It occurs to me that Santa Fe needs to be considered one of the locales under the spell of the Fayette Factor. Do you know about this? The Fayette Factor recognizes that U.S. towns named Fayette or Fayette or Lafayette or any other variation are haunted by weirdness. Frequent sightings of weird entities and apparitions, lots of UFO flaps, bizarre histories, 14 events like fish falling from the sky, spontaneous human combustion. The reason so many place names in the Eastern Time Zone in the Mississippi and Ohio River Valleys have Fayette or Fayette in their names is because of Lafayette. The French adventurer who became a central figure in the British colony's War of Independence, but it doesn't matter why a place has the sound Fay in its name. Because Fay is an old sound with an old resonance. Any modern witch knows that a spell is all about how you say it, how you intone it, how you sound it out, like, Fay is a sound that both attracts and creates a specific kind of energy. La Fay can mean the faith or of the beech tree, the beech trees of the sacred grove, where the old magicians and judges did their sacred work for the community. Lafayette is the L in L. Ron Hubbard. It's one of the oldest European surnames, first written down in Norman England in the 11th century. But surely in use since the Romans brought Latin to Gaul. When Julius Caesar checked the rise of Celtic Europe nearly 21 centuries ago, when phagos meant beech trees, a beech grove, the people of the beech trees, the druids who served as prophets, poets, and philosophers, as equals to the warlords, became known as La Fay. Lafayette was born to this adventurous family, and the reason so many places in the United States are named for him was mostly due to an incredible voyage he made back to America after the successful revolution that he supported with his talents and his money. It was 1784, and Lafayette was only 27 years old, a hero around the world. He traveled to every state in the Young Confederation, not yet a union, and he addressed the Virginia House of Delegates regarding the immediate need to emancipate the slaves, to achieve the liberty promised in the new country's founding document. There are more than 75 American cities and towns named for Lafayette, along with all kinds of counties and parks and squares, including Lafayette Square behind the White House, a square now completely walled off to the public by a great wall to protect the current occupant from the angry multitudes all around. And the theory, because Lafayette and its variations have a long association with strange and bizarre occurrences, is that the name itself carries some supernatural power. And if you think that's weird, well, what do you think's going on with the Lord's Prayer, 10 Hail Marys, a school fight song, benedictions, black magic? It's all words, spell casting, chanting, enchantment. Now here's a place that has long made me wonder. The Estrella Mountains, an incredible slab of rock rising 2,600 feet over the desert valley below, the Valley of the Sun, the Salt River Valley, the Gila River Valley. Sierra Estrella, to quote Arizona writer Stephen M. Thomas, is a solid block of 1.6 billion year old stone that was formed deep in the earth when molten rock erupted upward into a layer of sediment. That was around the time the first cells with a nucleus came into being here on planet Earth. Dinosaurs were still another billion plus years away. You know, sometimes I think junk DNA is just a schedule we haven't yet decoded. And here's why I make sure to pay my tithe to Wikipedia every year so I can quote something like this with mild impunity. Some non-coding DNA sequences must have important biological function. This is indicated by comparative genomic studies that report highly conserved regions of non-coding DNA, sometimes on timescales of hundreds of millions of years. This implies that these non-coding regions are under strong evolutionary pressure and positive selection. For example, in the genomes of humans and mice, which diverged from a common ancestor 65 to 75 million years ago, protein-coding DNA sequences account for only about 20% of conserved DNA, with the remaining 80% of conserved DNA represented in non-coding regions. There's a plan of some kind in there, I believe, a kind of grand story arc. No guarantee it'll happen, but it's a plan at least, loaded with contingencies, maybe. Trouble with the big land and water dinosaurs? Well, the flying dinosaurs can migrate. The Estrella Mountains are wild, a wild and harsh land that's nearly vertical in many places. Much of this mountain range is part of the 600 square mile Gila River Indian Nation, while some 14,000 acres our federal wilderness under the loose jurisdiction of the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. Like many mountain ranges and like many mountains in Arizona especially, there are all kinds of weird legends and strange folklore associated with these ancient, wild places. There are lost gold mines, of course, going back to the earliest Spanish explorations of this part of the Sonoran Desert. Ghost stories, of course, occasional monsters, ghost deer, terrifying apparitions. But the most common oddity, the usual anomaly, has to do with the very name the Spanish gave these mountains. Estrella, the stars. I have a long but shallow history with these mountains. My grandpa, the one who left eastern Kentucky with black lung from the coal mines, worked for a long time at the Goodyear factory just below the northern wall of the Estrellas. Working in a coal mine makes you appreciate the safety and human rights of workers, so my old grandpa Joe became the union steward at Goodyear, which is now a suburb of Phoenix, miles of two-story stucco tract houses right on top of each other along Interstate 10. On the southern end of this jagged range is the Estrella Sailport for gliders, sailplanes, just beyond the Maricopa Reservation. My dad would take me along now and then for a glider flight up and down the Estrellas. Thermals rise up from the desert plains, and then you get updrafts on both sides of the north-south mountain range. We would get a tow from a junky old Piper or Cessna somebody flew out there on weekends. And then we'd cut loose and soar over Arizona for an hour or two, chasing thermals. The best way to find a thermal is to watch the buzzards. They find a thermal and they just circle it lazily, thousands of feet above the parched ground, barely moving a muscle. Because sailplanes are totally silent, the turkey vultures would hold their spot and kind of glare over at us as we circled behind them. Even better is the fact that Estrella Sailport is glider only, no powered air traffic beyond the tow plane. It's a remarkably remote location, considering it's just south of the sprawling Phoenix metropolis. Living in old Phoenix all those years ago, you always heard about South Mountain. Of course you knew Camelback Mountain, even a dummy could pick that one out. But that big, long wall of rock to the southwest? Well, maybe because it's wilderness, maybe because there's no real road up to the top like South Mountain where you could drive up with a six-pack and your buddies and look at the city lights, or the Phoenix lights. Lots of people got to see that 1997 event from the South Mountain parking lot, looking down on the things. And then, if you remember your Phoenix Lights lore, once thousands more people went outside on that pleasant March night after they'd heard about the big boomerang and triangle-shaped formations moving low and slow from Prescott to Peoria to the Phoenix Mountains Preserve, well, then the masses saw a great arc of brilliant orange orbs over the Estrella Mountains. Now, some people right away said, well, that's not too far from Luke Air Force Base. Must be an immense line of flares dropped from aircraft like none of us have ever quite seen before. And then some of the alien faithful, you know, the ET believers who've seen too many science fiction movies, they said in their usual way, well, that must be a disinformation effort by the Air Force to hide the true alien spaceship somehow. But people who live around that 30-mile-long mountain range already knew about what they call the Estrella Lights. Now, why would the Spanish name a mountain range the Stars? Today, you might be able to make a little sense out of it because from the Estrellas, you can better see the night sky. But there was no light pollution on the valley floor when the Spaniards chose this name. The native peoples of the Salt River and the Gila River valleys lived without artificial light of any kind, as we all did, before electricity was tamed and brought into our homes in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The Pima and Maricopa tribes called the mountains Comanche, which means blue and hazy, like the Blue Ridge Mountains. Yeah, the origins of the Spanish name are obscured by time. Maybe the Spaniards were entranced by lights the indigenous peoples had long grown used to. the way Celtic peoples are matter-of-fact about the she, the fair folk who often appear in balls of light in nature. There was an article in the Arizona Republic a few years back, January 22 of 2015, and it was because Arizona had just been ranked number 7 on the list of U.S. states with the most UFO reports. Arizona ranks number 7 on a list of the top 10 states with the most UFO sightings, according to the National UFO Reporting Center. The more than 3,000 sightings in Arizona date back to 1950, the latest of which occurred January 13, when an observer spotted orange lights south of Phoenix near the Estrella Mountains, according to the UFO Reporting Center's website. A lot of people have been seeing orange lights near the Sierra Estrella for a long, long time. You go through the UFO database and it's just a steady supply. In June 2004, Phoenix suffered a massive blackout. Everything shut down, including all 3 reactors at the Palo Verde nuclear power plant. When the lights went out for 65,000 households on June 21st, there was yet another grouping of large orange lights hovering over the Estrellas. The lights persisted nightly for a week. Or maybe people were just out in numbers looking for them again. This happens whenever these strange occurrences make the local news. There are so many UFO sightings around the Estrellas that Gila Bend, an ancient river community on the southwest side of the mountains, has the most UFO sightings of anywhere in the United States or Canada, topping the list with 1,194 sightings per 100,000 people. And if you're thinking, well, Gila Bend barely has 2,000 people, welcome to the world of statistics. What it means is that a higher percentage of people in or passing through Gila Bend report strange things in the sky than in any other community or city in the United States or Canada. This is from New Fork, the National UFO Reporting Center in Washington State. Sedona's in the top 10, if you're wondering, in the tiny Sierra Nevada town of Sonora. And California comes right after Gila Bend. What's going on in those mountains? Now, these aren't total sightings. These are the people who took the trouble to find New Fork's phone number or website and then provided their report. Our friend Jason P. Woodbury, who grew up on the southeast side of the Estrellas, had his own experience with those brilliant circles of light in the sundown sky over the mountains called the Stars. Now, Jason and his whole household had a range of experiences, from seeing moon-sized lights move silently from horizon to horizon in seconds, to a low-flying formation of lights pacing one of their cars on a lonesome back road. I was talking to Jason about this last night, trying to figure out if the sightings he and his friends experienced a decade or so back had the Estrellas as their backdrop. And it appears to be the case. We are going to do a lot more work on this subject in the months ahead. I've been meaning to for years, but I keep forgetting about it. I was looking at some videos that people had shot over the last couple of decades of these strange orbs dancing around the Estrellas. And the comments beneath were pretty interesting. There's one from 11 years ago. I saw them spinning around each other. I'm not crazy. But if you tell me those are flares, you insinuate that I am crazy. Unless you can give me something to support their rotation about a center axis. One from 9 years ago. I used to live roughly 10 miles from the base of the east side of the Estrellas, so I'd frequently see these lights coming home on Pecos Road. They flare up, flare out, and then reappear a few hundred yards away. I originally thought they were hikers or campers starting fires, but they flare up and out too fast for that, and over too great a distance to be covered by people or vehicles, especially at night. I've lived out here in Maricopa since last October, and these things appear maybe once or twice weekly. They are not flares, since they hover in the sky stationary, and they don't fall like flares would. They go out, and then a few minutes later, they turn back on. I don't know what the hell they are. Another from 7 years ago, they head upwards, which I don't think flares can do. Plus, there are never smoke trails, and last week, I saw three other lights appear, and also going up almost at a 45 degree angle. When I say they go up, I mean they go down below the mountain line and then above it again. I try not to get caught up in the debate whether they're real or not. I have seen strange lights over the Estrella Mountains. They were moving up and down behind the mountain range like a serpent. It really freaked me out. Feels good to get back in the radio studio. This is Desert Oracle Radio, and I am your host, Ken Lane. The soundscapes that you've been listening to tonight are by Joshua Tree's own Red, Blue, Black, Silver. He's got CDs and all kinds of other stuff. Go look up Red, Blue, Black, Silver on the social media, whatever you use. Don't make me say the names of these things. From Amboy to Zizix and across the Great Mojave Wilderness, you've been listening to Desert Oracle Radio, broadcasting from Joshua Tree on Friday nights from 10 to 11 p.m. 107.7 on your FM dial in the high desert. You can stream it anywhere off the website. You can listen to the podcast if you like to do that. I was trying to wrap up the new issue of Desert Oracle, and look at that, I had to evacuate because of thick wildfire smoke, which all came into the headquarters here at the Desert Oracle Institute, courtesy of the Swamp Cooler, our only form of cooling. So I had to get out of here. But we're almost done. Hey, listen, the Desert Oracle hardcover book from MCD Books is coming out, is done. You can pre-order it on Bookshop or whatever online bookstore you like to use. And it's going to ship to you in the first week of December. I'm pretty happy with this collection. We'll speak with you again next week, same night, same time. Thank you for listening, and good night from the Voice of the Desert.
We are at the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. Well, I'm going to continue to read to you this week. This is excerpted from Campfire Stories, Volume 2, Tales from America's National Parks and Trails, edited by Dave Q and Elissa Q, published by Mountaineers Books, all rights reserved, read with permission. And this was written by Terry Tempest Williams. This is her piece in the book about Glacier National Park, and it's an excerpt from The Hour of Land, and it's telling a little more about the Blackfeet and their presence in what we now know as Glacier National Park. Glacier National Park is a landscape of change. Today, if you hike into the Granite Park Chalet, that's where she and her family stayed, on the Highline Trail, you will see evidence of the trapper fire in the standing forests of black burnt trees, now in a state of regeneration, marked by the magenta flares of fireweed. Hike up to the Grinnell Glacier and you will see more change from a different kind of heat. In 1850, 150 glaciers were recorded within the boundaries of Glacier National Park. In 2015, only 25 active glaciers remain. After decades of research, scientists have concluded that the glaciers for which the park was named could be gone within 15 years as a consequence of the burn of global warming. Climate change is not an abstraction here, but real change in real time. The rapid retreat of glaciers, rock once covered now lies bare. To touch warm granite beds once blanketed by glaciers is both a hard fact and a perversion. No longer do you see the chiseled high peaks defined by fields of snow. In the 20 years our family had been visiting Glacier National Park, from our first visit in 1982 to the fires of 2003, the absence of ice was disorienting and unnerving. A vital characteristic of the terrain is being erased by global warming. The geographic relief of the mountains was rendered monochromatic and bland. The crown of the continent is slipping. I wonder what the mountain goats are thinking. These beasts, the color of winter. In this part of the world, predicting the future is a foolish proposition. No one knows this better than the Blackfeet Nation. They are the true witnesses of change. The Blackfeet Reservation borders Canada to the north and Glacier National Park to the west, what the elders call the backbone of Mother Earth. The Blackfeet have been living in this landscape for generations, spanning hundreds of years and thousands more before that. with the knowledge of their ancestors still present through ceremonies and stories shared, contemporary Blackfeet are able to reach back through time and reclaim traditional wisdom, just as they are in the process of reclaiming the land that was once theirs. When Glacier National Park was established in 1910, the Blackfeet were displaced and physically removed from their home ground, where the men hunted bison on horseback and women gathered berries and roots for their families. It wasn't just their food that was derived from the land, but all their medicine as well. Not only were they removed from the sources of subsistence, but they lost access to much of the land where their spiritual life took place. They were not only ripped from the land where they lived, but torn from their spiritual traditions, inhibiting songs, dreams, prayers, and ceremonies, especially those ceremonies and vision quests practiced within the site of Chief Mountain, a geologic formation central and sacred to the tribe. By the laws of another nation, foreign and disconnected from their own, the Blackfeet were not only displaced, but deceived by the U.S. government, disregarded and dismissed as a sovereign nation with rights. The first superintendent of Glacier National Park, William Richard Logan, was no friend to the tribes, even though he was an Indian agent to the Assiniboine and Gros Ventre at the Fort Belknap Reservation. He wanted Blackfeet land for the minerals believed to be in the mountains and for the future economic value of tourism. In 1895, the U.S. government initiated a deal with the Blackfeet Nation to trade the western mountains on their reservation, rumored to be filled with gold, in exchange for cash and the continued non-mineral rights to hunt and fish on their land as they always had done. White Calf, one of the Blackfeet leaders, said, "I would like to have the right to hunt game and fish in the mountains. We will sell you the mountain lands from Birch Creek to the boundary, reserving the timber and grazing land." Pressured to sign the agreement, the Blackfeet asked for $3 million. They were paid half that by the federal government. George Bird Grinnell was one of the government negotiators and an early advocate for Glacier National Park. He gave his word to the Blackfeet that they could retain their hunting and fishing rights as long as those lands remained public. But upon the opening of Glacier National Park in 1910, their native rights were revoked on the technicality that these were no longer public lands, but park lands. It made no sense other than Indian removal. The Blackfeet were denied, with some Indians even being arrested, the previous access that they had been promised. Where is the valor in these actions taken by the U.S. federal government? With the Voices of Yellowstone First Peoples celebration going on at Yellowstone National Park this week, I also wanted to know about the indigenous people's history in that region. Here's the audio from a YouTube video that was produced by the Wyoming Cultural History Guide. The title is American Indians of Yellowstone.
I'm Julie Francis, archaeologist with the Wyoming Department of Transportation. Yellowstone and its geology played a very important role in the spiritual and religious beliefs of a lot of people. The Yellowstone Plateau is perched across the Continental Divide, and it straddles what early anthropologists defined as three major culture areas. These include the Columbia Plateau, the Great Plains, and the Great Basin. Many tribes believed that supernatural beings resided in some places within the park.
Well, we do currently have 26 tribes that are formally associated with Yellowstone, and for a lot of them, they have absolutely spiritual connections to thermal areas and elsewhere throughout the park as well.
The geysers and the mud volcanoes were seen as portals to the supernatural world and were used by many different groups for fasting and for vision questing. The Crow used the park area extensively and considered it part of their homeland. They used the area for hunting, they used it for gathering plants, as well as various minerals that might have been used in pigments and paints. They still retain place names for locations within the park. The Kiowa, who now reside in Oklahoma, part of their origin myth is that their people were essentially created and born somewhere in the mountains immediately to the north of Yellowstone. Thus, Yellowstone National Park and the surrounding area figures very prominently in their cultural identity. The Nez Perce used to hunt buffalo on the east side of the Bitterroot Mountains in Montana, and were very familiar with this area even before the 1877 Nez Perce War. The Bannocks also hunted in this area. The Blackfeet also traveled through the park on many of their raids throughout western Wyoming and this area. The Salish-speaking Flathead and Pendarai also came into this area for hunting and other uses. The Eastern Shoshone, what we now also think of as the Wind River Shoshone, considered this part of their aboriginal land claims. They led military expeditions through the park on well-worn and used Indian trails and had intimate knowledge of the geography and resources of the region. The Shoshone consisted of autonomous bands, politically autonomous bands, that were often named by the principal food resource. So hence in the mountains here, with the abundant evidence of sheep trapping, we have the sheep eaters. Over in the Idaho area, we have salmon eaters using the vast salmon resources of the snake. There were the root diggers, as well as the buffalo eaters, who were more adapted to a plains lifeway. The only permanent residents that we can identify are the Mountain Shoshone, or also known as the sheep eaters. In fact, the sheep eaters were extremely sophisticated hunters of mountain sheep, highly skilled flint knappers. Ancestors of the Shoshone, including the sheep eaters, created some of the most complex rock art that we know, not only in this region, but in the world. It's known as the Dinwiddie tradition, and it's found in areas surrounding Yellowstone Park.
I was just kind of rooting around in the grass the other day next to the house, and we have a lot of wild strawberries, and oh man, are they delicious. I have not seen many huckleberries out in our neighborhood where we live, but the strawberries are there. Have you been out berry hunting along with the bears these days? Well, here's a little piece from Montana Natural History Center Field Notes. And the title is Tantalizing Baneberries.
It's time for Field Notes, brought to you by the Montana Natural History Center. I don't know about you, but it's not often the word tantalizing applies to my existence. Its suggestion of dangerous temptation, of irresistible yet unattainable delight, seems a bit melodramatic when applied to the last bowl's worth of Moose Tracks ice cream burning a hole in the freezer. A neighborhood 10-year-old once informed me that the disarray of spices, herbs, and teas on a shelf over my sink made me seem like a witch, which, if true, would be the only hint of mysterious danger in my drab, indoorsy life. But let me tell you about baneberries. I was in the Rocky Mountain front last summer picking huckleberries with some friends, their lovable ding-dong of a dog, and a berry-happy bear who stayed a few steps ahead of us all day, but left steaming evidence of his presence for us to find. Lodgepole pines shaded a low carpet of bountiful huckleberry bushes. Dark orbs, some on brazen display, others hiding shyly behind a smooth, oblong leaf, drew us on and on, searching for more. After several hours of collecting berries and stuffing our faces, to no noticeable detriment of the supply, we shouldered our packs and moved on down the trail. It was then, fresh from the hunt, with my heart still turned towards berries, that I saw them. Rising above the thicket on a single stalk was a cluster of red berries. Bright red berries. Glossy red berries that gleamed like a beacon in the shade. Berries that whispered, "Eat me," in a hue of red so vivid it promised death. I stopped and stared. That red. Into my mind, suddenly blank of everything except those berries, a word dropped like a pebble into a still pool. Tantalizing. The spell was broken when my friend informed me that these were baneberries. Taller than the huckleberry thicket, the baneberry bush stood about waist high, full of three-lobed, sharply serrated leaves that would cast any self-respecting poison ivy avoider into fits of suspicion. As the name and berry suggest, this plant is poisonous to humans. The pleasant symptoms that will beset you upon eating baneberries include burning of mouth and throat, severe stomach cramps and diarrhea, headache, dizziness, hallucinations, and, if you are a small child, death. Baneful indeed. The chemical compounds that cause these reactions remain unknown, but birds are unaffected and eat the berries freely. They are the primary seed dispersers for this plant. I turned away, and we continued our trek behind the elusive bear. Long after the trip ended, that moment of what? Discovery? Temptation? Ensorcelment? Stayed with me. Not only the image of the glistening berries themselves, but the word that arrived to describe them. Tantalizing. It turns out, the etymology of this word traces back to the Greek myth of Tantalus, a king who tried to steal from the gods. As punishment, he was made to stand in a pool of water up to his neck. Overhead dangled ripe, luminous fruits. When Tantalus reached up to assuage his hunger and thirst, the branches drew away, away, away. He could not eat the fruit. Fruit! How is it that I, millennia after Tantalus, half a world away in the montane forests of Montana, sweaty and berry-stained, should find myself drawn so powerfully to a fruit that it invokes this specific word? Tantalizing, a word for fruit. I am no witch, despite the neighbor's opinion of my spice rack, but it seems there are spells of some sort at work here. Nature's power to speak, even through a lowly red berry, and humanity's imagination in the presence of nature's power, sharing words and stories across time, cultures, and continents. I don't know about you, but it makes me want to get outside more and more often. Today's field note was written in the Field Notes Writing Workshop at the Montana Natural History Center. I'm Alyssa Rago for Field Notes, brought to you by the Montana Natural History Center, providing natural history education for schools and the public throughout Montana. To find out about upcoming events and programs at the center, call 327-0405. Or visit our website at montananaturalist.org.
Well, we have some events coming up this week I wanted to tell you about. As I mentioned earlier, the Voices of Yellowstone First Peoples Celebration is going on in Yellowstone National Park. For the schedule of events, and most are free, go to www.yellowstone.org/voices-of-yellowstone/. And the cultural tours are booked up for Sunday and Monday, but at this point you can still go to sign up Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, or Saturday at www.yellowstone.org/cultural-tours/. And I'll repeat that for you. www.yellowstone.org/cultural-tours/. Remember, these tours cost $50 apiece, and you do need to register to attend. Seats are limited to 12 for each tour. A little closer to Bozeman, there will be a lakeshore cleanup August 7th from 6 to 9 p.m., Friends of Highlight and Gallatin Watershed Council are hosting the cleanup in Highlight Recreation Area as part of the Friends Summer Stewardship Series. Meet in the main lot at the Highlight Day Use Boat Ramp at 6 p.m. The Forest Service will provide gloves, trash bags, and magnet sweepers. Volunteers do not need to sign up. You can just show up. See you there. My thanks to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for their continuing work on Desert Oracle Radio. Our sounds today came from birds in my yard and maybe some sounds from around the rest of the Gallatin Valley. And readings came from Campfire Stories, Volume 2. Thank you, Gallatin Valley, and everyone for listening today. You can leave me a message or text about anything on your mind. The number is 406-404-6246. You can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgbm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgbm.org website. A running theme of our show today has been the way a place or the use of a place changes as time goes on. The place where our house sits used to be a ranch. So today I'm having Watch House take us out with their song Echo. The words speak for themselves. See you next week. Stay well and sweet dreams.
Just listen to wildfires grow. Such whispers on the breeze, they don't come easy now. Over all this noise, spent my youth among the pines. They used to sing a tune so fine, and the wind moved like an echo, carried. I saw it in a dream. Monuments of trees as the air we breathe turned our lungs to dust. And the redwoods so tall, and all their all began to rust. With no bend and sway at all, that ancient dance was lost. And the wind moved like an echo beside an every gut. Funny wine where the coffee grows on the wild. sugar-coated mountains, and the spring began to melt into sweetest dreams. Reach night to starlight and the sea, together form eternity. And the wind moves like an echo as the world drops off.